So I've seen it twice, and I filmed it, and we all know, most people have seen the interview, but I was still on the edge of my seat. So I think that's a real achievement to the writer and the director, and it's a sort of, the royalty of British acting, which is just, it's a pleasure to be a tiny part of, doing their thing. And I found it really, I found it kind of exciting and thrilling, and you know what's coming in the interview, but you still think, oh, he's not going to say that, is he? You've been on a run of these, Darren, right? You just doing back to back.
Oh man, you have no idea.
Oh man, I just
it's been a busy week. But that's okay. I mean, it's fun because I get to talk to so many awesome people, which is cool. I love hearing the stories and stuff,
Great.
and movies is my thing, so there's that. So
Oh, good. Good. So how long have you been doing this?
Since about 2017.
Wow.
Yeah, it's been a bit. We just I have I'm actually, this is my fourth show. I have four shows going on.
Wow.
So my one show just went over the 100 episode mark, which was kind of cool this summer.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. I was like, wow, that's a lot. And I'll be at 100 on this show probably by the end of the year, most likely.
Okay.
So, but enough about me, man. I mean, shh. So before we jump in, for those of you who are listening, I'm Darren Jenkins. This is Drop the Mic, and I am being joined by a wonderful, wonderful actor, one of Britain's most prolific young classical actors who you can see right now. It dropped today on Netflix. You can see him playing Jason Stein, the Prince Andrew's former PR advisor, on Netflix's newest film, Scoop, which I watched. I got up at 9 o'clock and watched it this morning.
Wow.
I was like,
Fair play to you. Amazing.
it's such a good film, though, man.
Right? I mean, we got to see it. We went to a private car screening, and then we went to the sort of premiere in the West End. And so I've seen it twice, and I filmed it. And we all know, most people have seen the interview, but I was still on the edge of my seat. So I think that's a real achievement to the writer and the director, and it's a sort of, the royalty of British acting, which is just, it's a pleasure to be a tiny part of, doing their thing. And I found it really, I found it kind of exciting and thrilling, and you know what's coming in the interview, but you still think, oh, he's not going to say that, is he? And it's kind of edge of your seat stuff, and somehow they've managed to make them, through the director and I think the great actors playing those lead roles, they're all human beings, which in an hour 40 minutes is kind of an achievement,
Well, I'm gonna confess something here on this podcast. I hadn't seen the interview
Okay,
at that
wow.
before, so I actually watched the interview first this morning,
You couldn't write it. You couldn't write
I
it, right?
was like, what struck me about So I watched the interview, and then I watched the film, and what struck me was how, because I don't even know how to explain this. It was such a the his interview was so, I don't even know, like, we're having challenges here in the US with our own master of deception, Donald Trump. And it just felt like this dude was not, he just didn't understand the scope of what he had done. And what I found from the movie, which you included, was how human all the human stories around the telling of that story, which I found fascinating.
Yeah, and how something like that comes to be, and the reasons why people do what they do.
Yeah.
For something like that to happen, that what I think is remarkable in what Rufus Sewell does, he plays Andrew. I mean, he's, you know, you meet him in real life, his eyes twinkly, he's sort of, you know, one of the world's most handsome men. And there he is, and, you know, with all the prosthetics and stuff, and it's kind of extraordinary transformation. But somehow, he's not trying to apologize for him or his baby, but what he shows is that everyone's a sort of product of their upbringing, the environment they're born into, the sense of entitlement that he captures is extraordinary. Why the people close to him, you know, are looking out for him. Why people do stuff out of loyalty. What drives other people. I think that what drives different people in it is really clear. And everyone's being driven for different reasons towards this same place, which is this interview,
right,
which he thinks and Amanda Thirsk, the woman who's sort of, they think it's going to save him and get his life back. And what's remarkable is that he still thinks he's nailed it. You know, at the end of it, he thinks it's gone. It's gone great.
He's in charming. That tub, fully like.
he's nailed it. He's smashed it. Yeah.
Your character too, which I thought was fascinating, because. And I said this to, I was walking around the house trying to thinking about this movie today. And I stopped and I go, you know, if they had just listened to him.
Right. There's always one that, there's always someone like that in history. So like in Greek mythology, the Cassandra figure, someone's sort of screaming like, you know, the world's going to end. And no one listens to them.
Right.
And so he's a real dude. And he was very kind. He very kindly met up with me. I went to sort of visit him. It was very swanky.
Oh, so you did actually get to talk to him.
Yeah, I did. And he was very generous with his time. And I think he was pleased to be part of the film, even if it's not, you know, it's not the central kind of story. But it's an important aspect of it, that there is someone there that recognizes that going on TV, being on Newsnight, it wasn't the play that he was thinking that they should make. And he had quite a clear idea that, slowly you just bring in journalists one by one. He spends time with them, and print media was the way he was thinking of, just sort of rebuilding his reputation, and they knew that they needed him, you know, and he was this sort of young hotshot guy, and they knew they needed him. But increasingly, as he was there, I think he felt that, because he was the one saying television isn't the way, you stick with the plan, it's going to take a while, but because of what, and I think what the film captures, the urgency once Epstein had been arrested, and that produced a new urgency. And therefore he was kind of, what he was saying was sidelined a bit. And he was saying, don't do it. And he got ignored. And I think that he probably was proved right in some ways. It wasn't the thing to do, but there's always someone like that. You know, when big stuff goes down, there's always someone on the sidelines sort of waving the flag and saying, just don't do it. And often they get ignored.
The Amanda, who was played by Keeley Hawes, who, by the way, she was so good. Like,
she's so great. Yeah.
And you know, this person that she is, I felt bad for her in a lot of, because she it was weird. It was like weird. You almost felt sympathetic for him through her, because she wanted so much to help him. And, you know, I think she truly believed that what she was trying to do was to kind of rebuild his this person. And like at the end, it just, I think they should do a documentary just on her afterwards, because that has to have been very hard for her to have to deal with
very
afterwards.
Hard. Yeah, and the sort of what she portrays so beautifully, the sort of the loyalty that comes with those people that we work for, that sometimes we don't always see the faults that are kind of obvious to the rest of the world. We see the good in people, and if we she's driven out of loyalty. She's probably worked for him, you know, for a number of years.
Right.
And there's a level of care if you're someone's sort of personal assistant. And that she, and I think that she, in a really sort of subtle, beautiful way, she sort of conveys that love, care, and loyalty. So, yeah, and the, you know, first day on set to get to do my scenes with her and Rufus. And because they're kind of screen legends and so much experience, I remember what we had one of these sort of, kind of, and I was sort of thrust in there.
Right.
One of the takes, Keely's very generous, but she, you know, she was had to sort of slightly guide me around to make the camera move because it comes second nature to her because she's, you know, her body of work is extraordinary. Right. And I was absolutely fine being sort of handled and moved in the right places. You know, I said to her, you just, you move me where I need to go. Because on your first day, you know, the nerves are there and, you know, she's just, they're so, those guys are like, well-trained athletes and so I was happy, you know, just to ease myself in. You and I said to her, you move me where you need me to be.
How did you get the role? How did you end up on
it was one of those one of the UK's greatest casting directors, Nina Gold. Her associate Martin Ware. I mean they've cast everything. And I remember speaking to my agent and I sort of, you know, one of the things we said, it's like Nina Gold, you know, that's the person that I need to kind of get back on her radar. And, it was very, it was down to them, as is always the way. They don't really get mentioned casting directors, right. But they're the ones that think of you and put you in front of a director. So nowadays, this is the way with acting, you put something on tape. First, you take it yourself.
Self-tapes, sure.
So that's the way the industry's changed, and actually, it's one of those changes that I love.
Really,
I love the fact. Yeah, I'd much rather, especially first round, I'd much rather tape by myself because you sort of you're never happy with what you do,
right.
But you have some level of quality control. And often, when you go in and meet first time round, you bring in the journey of, you know, taking the subway. You might have been late. It might have been, you know, you had trouble getting your kids off to school that morning. And sometimes you bring that into the room.
I never thought about that.
And you've got 10 minutes. And often when I'm taping myself, the first two takes that I do are kind of horrible. And that's what I would have done in the room. So when this script came up, I sometimes you get something you think, yeah, I could do something with this. I can see who this guy is. Sometimes you get stuff and you do your best, right. But you just know it's not quite you. Other times it's so you that you try too hard to show it's you. And then you get scripts like this. You think, I know what this guy's going to be like. I think I know what you want, what you might want. So I put it on tape. I knew they liked it. And I got a recall to go and meet the director in person, Philip Martin, who must be one of the nicest guys I've ever met. And on set was just one of those people. I think that it comes from the top. He's generous and gracious. And he's done so much of this kind of work around the royal family. He's done, you know, some of the best episodes.
Yeah, The Crown. I mean, you know.
So he was just, it brings out the best in you because it was the same when I met him for the recall, is that he's there rooting for you. He nurtures you. He drops in ideas and suggestions and you never feel that you're being, you just feel you're being guided and helped and you can work together on something. So I met him. And then even then, after I met, I knew the recall had gone well, but there was a lot of moving parts trying to put this the cast together. They had so many sort of such a wide, big cast and a lot of, you know, great British actors involved. So it took quite a long time after the recall. I knew it had gone well. I knew they liked me, but the confirmation didn't come for like 3 months later. And it was about, so it ended up being about a week before the read through that they finally were able to say, yes, you've got the role. And then it's so to be able to go in to do that read through with, you know, like I say, some, you know, royalty of British actors and then start filming about a week after that was a real gift. So it was, it was a real, the sort of thing that I've been wanting because I've done so much theatre and it was exactly the thing that I kind of wanted to step up and start doing the last couple of years. So I feel very grateful that I was part of it.
I mean, like, On my other podcast, my co-host Chris Saunders, if he's listening, he'll smile at this. He has this thing where he loves the little nuances that the actors will throw in, you know, like to kind of really bring like life to a certain moment. And when you're telling them, look, I'm not doing this. I'm just not doing this. I was like, I felt the palpable like frustration, which I was like, wow, okay, that's 2 minutes that he's like, I got 2 minutes on the screen. Bam, I'm coming to hit it.
Thank you. I mean, it's funny, as is always the way with, you know, when you filmed, there was other scenes that you film that don't often the way with a sort of role like this, it's great to read the writer's initial vision for that character, because it was in the initial draft, it was sort of more fleshed out, had more scenes, a longer build up to winning Prince Andrew's trust. So you have all that, but you kind of, when you're involved in a project, you watch the editing process. You see that first draft, and then you have all that you've taped initially. So that's kind of all going on inside. And then everything gets streamlined as they get to the heart of the story. So then you get this sort of shooting copy of the script, which you're like, all right, so it's not as many scenes as a tape, but oh yeah, you read it in context and you think, yeah, this is the story about the women around, these amazing women around Andrew. And so you understand that your role is really as a foil opposite Keely Hawes' character, Amanda Thirsk, and just this sort of, this figure that's saying, that did sort of shine the light and go, this is a bad idea. And there was a couple of other scenes, you know, we had another couple of nice scenes with Keely that, again, didn't make the edit. And then you see the film and you think, right, because there's a scene with Andrew and Amanda Thirsk when they talk about Jason says, let's just keep to the strategy. So in that one line, you save yourself 3 minutes. So you don't need to show the scene. And it's one of those, I think when you start out as an actor, you kind of take those things personally. But actually, as you get older, you recognize that your job is to serve the story. And it's not a comment on the quality of your work or the scene. And you meet everyone else at the screening, and everyone's had to lose some scenes. And it's for the sake of this overall story and the drive of the story. And you just need him to be this someone saying, I told you so. And that the poor guy wasn't able to do his job. He was brought in, he had a clear strategy, and then he kind of got overruled and sidelined. And you can't work like that. If you're not going to listen to what I'm saying, then he had to go.
Well, at that level, PR is such a hard job, man. I mean, I wouldn't want to have been that dude.
They're clearing up messes, that you're trying to, and what's interesting is that if they had kept him on, he would have been able to clear up the mess, the fallout, better as well. But he wasn't, by that time, it's dramatized and simplified in the movie. But a lot of the time, PR companies, you think that the mess politicians get themselves into, all the kind of scandals that go on in the world, you're there clearing up and mess.
Mess was not necessarily something you probably wanted to have cleaned up, to be honest. I mean, and as you think about it, the women, like what he was being accused of and what the company he was keeping, that kind of thing. And it ends up being women that ultimately, they are the ones also behind telling the story. Even from Amanda's point of view, to a certain degree, she has a hand in it, telling that story.
Setting up absolutely. It's I think the film, and I think what the film does brilliantly with those sort of phenomenal actors, it's these incredible women, very different women that end up driving towards this interview, and the sort of shockwaves it's sent through, the royal family, through, and that kind of reached across the world, because I mean in America they kind of, there's a fascination with our royal family. And I think without overdoing that, you get a glimpse of the sort of I don't think they knew quite what an impact that interview would have. But yeah, I mean, it was really interesting meeting him and hearing his story. So it's all that stuff. You hear all this stuff and you kind of, and I got a feeling of, you know, physically we looked quite different. But I tried to just capture, you want to kind of capture the essence of someone and bring that into it. And that even if once you've spent that time with someone and you've done that, you've had that chat, you can't show it all in a couple of scenes, but hopefully it's just in there and it will come through that, you know, this, I was, little things that you probably wouldn't, the nuance maybe wouldn't carry across in America, but the fact that I assumed he'd be from London and he was actually from the north of England, from Manchester. And so that was a really nice thing I could bring in. And he had these very particular glasses that, you know, I was adamant that we got to do that. But yeah, it's just, you want to kind of, and I saw him at the premiere, Jason, and he seems very happy with like what we did, what we ended up doing. And like a fascinating guy, you know, that he ended up sort of working class background in the north of England. And then he ends up, he's sort of PR for some of, you know, for the royal family, for high level politicians, and now for a sort of big firm in London. And, you know, he's clearly just got street smarts about him, you know, he gets the gig.
How did you, I watched it this morning. I'm watching it and I'm seeing Prince Andrew, who is played by Rufus Sewell. I'm watching this actor on screen. I was like, wow, this dude, whoever this is, really good. And I did not know he was in prosthetics until I was like reading the cast list and I saw his name. I'm like, I didn't see him in this movie. What movie? What movie? And I had to roll and look at the picture. I'm like, holy smokes. So for anybody who doesn't know Rufus Sewell, that can't be many people, but one of my favorite TV shows of all time is his show, The Man from the High Castle. He is such a good actor. What was it like working with him?
Oh, what a pleasure. And you know, it's funny. It's like you can see, even at the read-through, the amount of time and research and hard. That's the thing, often when you get to kind of work with these great actors, that talent is only, like, it's just one tiny part of why they're so successful. It's the hard work and the graft. They work hard. They work really hard. You know, just that Judi Dench isn't Judi Dench because she's Judi Dench.
She's not just rolling in there or, you know, out of bed.
It's everything that goes with it. It's the way that they, the generosity, the kind of the generosity with the other cast members, the fact that everyone in the crew, they're kind, they know them by first name basis. It's all that work ethic that every time you see someone like that work, and you're like, this is why you've got to where you are. So he'd been doing the work and the study, hours of just studying that interview. And you can tell also in a read through that Rufus did a lot of theatre work before his TV career really took off. And so the way he handles text, it's just with such skill and dexterity. And you kind of think that's probably a lot of that comes from the background that you've had in theatre. But it's always the same. It's like the people at the very top, they seem the ones that are kind of the hardest working, the nicest to be around. And it's sometimes the people just beneath that might have a bit more of a chip on their shoulder and don't always treat other people with respect. So it's just like Philip Martin, the director, absolute gentleman, Rufus, Keeley, just delightful to work with. And it was exactly the same when I got to do, I played Laertes when Jude Law was playing Hamlet.
Oh, really?
Quite a long time ago. Coming up, this was back in 2008, I think, in the West End. And that, I mean, it was just, that blew me away, the way that he was exactly the same. He worked harder than anyone. He made sure he came to everyone's dressing room before the show every night to check in with them. He'd take us all out when we finished the week of performances and, you know, get us all drinks and a meal. You know, it's that kind of level of care, knew everyone's name. And that's the stuff that I've really tried to learn from, is that when, if I've been leading the company in a theatre show or something, is it's that, you know, even if I might not be the most sociable or something, that I'd always try and treat people with respect, know them by name, and lead by example through like hard work. And that's what people like Rufus and, you know,
do. Since you've done theater and now you're, you know, obviously you're doing television. What do you think, like, what are the differences when it comes to the kind of pressure of performing in front of a live audience versus in front of a camera?
I've sort of thought, I used to think they were more different, and they are different in some ways, television and screen work and then theatre. But it's there's something about theatre that you're kind of having to recreate, you know, 100 performances, but the audience are coming and they need to feel that they're seeing it for the first time, that you've never said those words before. And there's a skill in that of pretending that you're new minting the words for the first time. And what I love about filming, and it's quite addictive, is it's the sort of immediacy of the pressure, is that you'd be waiting around and then suddenly you're on and you've got about 5 or 6 different technical things. You've got to reach a certain point at a certain time. You've got to turn, the camera might move, so you've got to shift your position. And I love those sort of boundaries and being given to you, and the adrenaline rush of suddenly being on. So, what's been interesting, Darren, is that over the last few years, I think during lockdown and homeschooling, is understanding and, you know, seeing in my spending that time with my daughters, and then I kind of like, I think you might have ADHD, and then I kind of found out about
really?
It. I've definitely got ADHD, so we both got diagnosed. And so now I really understand why, in some ways, acting, when you're kind of, it's probably the worst possible profession for someone with ADHD, because you're dependent on external validation. It's very hard to get motivated yourself. But you take criticism, you can take it quite badly. But at the same time, you're the sort of dopamine hit that you get from being on stage to an audience. And same when the camera's rolling and it's like action. If I know what I'm doing and I feel confident in it, I love that feeling of suddenly being on. And I can see now it's a dopamine hit, and all the motivation and the pressure, it's coming from outside. You're not having to generate it yourself. And that's, as I'm understanding more about ADHD, it's about a deficit of motivation. And when you get given that from the outside, that's when you kind of switch on. So it's a rush. It's like, I, before becoming an actor, I played drums, and it was the same sort of, played jazz drums, and the same thing, that sort of thrilling feeling when something's just cooking and you're playing, and it's a thrill, it's a drug, and it's addictive. And that you get that on stage when you're in a show, and that you know you're doing a good job and you're giving the audience an amazing time, and you're entertaining people. And there's definitely a thrill that comes from when the camera's rolling and you have to hit something. I've always put a lot of pressure on myself, and I'm sort of learning not to be hard on myself. It's amazing how much you carry on learning, you know. I'm into my 40s now. Yeah. I've been doing it 20 years and I'm just learning all the time.
It's a lot like that for comedians as well. For me, like, as a when you're on, you know, when you're doing either live improv or if you're doing a stand-up comedy, it is like, it's one of the scariest things you can possibly want to do.
Yeah.
But at the same time, after you've done it, man, you just like want to get back up there again.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there's that feeling, like, I guess, if, you know, maybe if as a stand-up, if you're, you know, you're trialing some new material for the first time, and the same way you do that first preview, it's the first time you share the story with the world, right? And you're running around like, you know, brainless chickens backstage. You have no idea where you're going, people are shoving you on, but it's such a thrill. You're never that level of focus and attention. It's totally, and you're kind of thinking, how's this ever going to feel natural? And then, like, a few weeks later, the play plays itself. You know, you in the same way you're set, like you know it, and then you're so comfortable probably in what you're doing that then you can really react to what the audience are bringing that night, and you can play off that because everything else just exists. You've got this framework that's there, but you it is those the level of fear. You kind of think that the payoff has to be worth it, that you put yourself through that level of kind of, you know, hair of the, you know, seat of the pants or whatever, you know, phrase, and you're just out there and you're hitting and hoping and you get through it and you think, wow, it happened, you know, and you can't, that afternoon, you have no idea how it's going to happen. And it does. But that's the last I did, it's the last 2022, I did sort of three really interesting theatre shows back to back. And then last year I thought, I'm going to just try and stay available. I'm not going to say yes to the theatre so I can end up, you know, doing these TV projects. So it was, I'm now feeling, having not done theatre for a year, like I could go back and do some, you know, if the right thing came along. But I really needed to take some time away from it last year.
So you said you were a drummer before you became an actor. How did, so how did that, how, like, what was the, what's the transition there?
Yeah. I know, it's really, it was one of those things that, I hope my, you know, very lucky, incredibly supportive parents. And, but I think that back at the time when I was a kid, so both, I've got two incredibly talented brothers who are both musicians and they carried on doing it. And I remember at the time when I was 18, I came to London to do a history degree. And when I was in London, I really wanted to be in London so I could carry, you know, because I was gigging and, you know, I was as a teenager, I was drumming all over the place. So I did this history degree, but I was playing sort of Ronnie Scott's jazz club and jazz cafe and all the jazz clubs around London on the weekends and still managed to do my history degree. And then it was just at university that I ended up getting involved a little bit with the theatre department as well. And I hadn't really done much acting since I was a kid and it sort of gone off the radar for the drumming. But I quite enjoyed it and I was quite good at it. And then I remember finishing finishing my history degree. I knew I wasn't going to be a historian. I thought I was going to be a drummer, but I auditioned, someone said I should audition to drama school. And I auditioned to a great school called Lambda on the off chance, just went on their last sort of weekend of auditions to see what happened, and they offered me the place. And so then I thought, and then I still didn't know if I could go, and then they offered me a scholarship. So my mind was kind of made up. And so I went there and studied acting for 2 years, but I still didn't know if I was going to be an actor. I still thought I was going to be a drummer. And then I got a great agent and I still didn't know if I was going to be an actor. So my first couple of years out, I was sort of doing, you know, weddings and stuff on the weekend. That was how I paid my way. And then increasingly over time, I was getting more acting work and I couldn't make the sort of band rehearsals anymore. And I just sort of let it just kind of disappear. It wasn't sudden, it slowly disappeared. And I remember, I don't know if you've got siblings, Darren, but I remember it was my way of probably choosing, I wanted to do my own thing.
I know exactly what you mean.
I think.
Yeah.
Do you know that feeling? Yeah, I sort of probably that it's being a middle child, you want to find your own path in life. And I think that there was probably a moment that even if it was subconscious, that I was like, I'm going to do that because that'll be my thing. And I'm very fortunate that I've been able to make a career out of it. And
so are your siblings in the music? Music?
Yeah, they're both in the music business. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So me doing drama, like becoming an actor, I think it was my way of being, sort of saying, yeah, I'm going to be my own person. You know, you're kind of middle child syndrome, right?
Hey, trust me, it happens for the youngest child too. I'm
does it? I'm the youngest. You're the younger.
My brother, when we were young, he's an artist, and he drew comic books for like Marvel and DC and all these, you know, the big comic book companies here.
Wow.
And I kind of was I wanted to be an actor, but my father did not want me to be an actor. He was like, nope.
Yeah.
He's like, you can do something art related that's business related. So he tried to force me down the same path my brother was going, which was from the comic book art into like advertising, business advertising. And I hated it. And the same. So I kind of did the same thing you did where I just went into the film. Once I got old enough to say, make my own choices, I was like, I just want to be an actor, man. I don't want to be identified as, you know, Keith's little brother who does the same thing I do, you know.
Yeah, you don't want to be so-and-so's brother. You want to be your own person. And I think, and I'm really glad that I did, but it's interesting that there's some things that you can take agency of in your life, that choice. But even then, you know, in the creative industries, you're so much at the mercy of other people's decision-making. And it's like the industry will tell you what you're good at and what they want to see you do. So, and then you kind of get caught on a path, and then you have to try and make the decision to maybe move and do something else. So when I'd been out a few years, and then I've been fortunate enough to work with like some of the greatest directors, you know, in theatre, and they've totally, I owe them so much for not only just giving me the job, but much more teaching me about stuff. So it was 2007. I worked with a guy called Declan Donnellan, who runs a company called Cheap by Jowl. He cast me out of nowhere, sort of cast me as the lead in Troilus and Cressida, which was then touring around Europe. And so I'd be suddenly up from sort of doing smaller parts, I was suddenly a lead role in a Shakespeare. And I hadn't wanted to do Shakespeare, but that he saw something in me. And because the way he talks about, he understands human beings so well, it was like having a life coach as well as a director. Yeah, he just understands kind of how messed up we are. and he shone a light on Shakespeare that made me, that something I thought was really sort of dull and boring. It completely opened my eyes to this, that we kind of have the wrong kind of reverence for him. We obsess over his language, and we sort of forget that he's a playwright, that he writes these great words, but it's like in any play, it's what those words, it's the characters and story that they, you know, give you a window into, that's what's so crazy and so remarkable. And he kind of taught me that there's a sort of received way that people think plays should be, but actually for him, moments that people assumed were funny were actually really darkly tragic, and moments that you thought were tragic were actually hilarious. And so having done that job for him, I then went into, I got to work with the great director Michael Grand as this Donmar season in the West End. So I got to play Sebastian in Twelfth Night, and then I got to play Laertes, Jude Law's Hamlet. And so suddenly I was on this Shakespeare path, which I hadn't planned. And it was like that. The industry was telling me, and actually I was quite good at it. I managed to find a way to make Shakespeare sound quite natural. And because of the stuff I'd done with the work that I'd done with my great mentor, Declan, I was able to hopefully bring this sort of freshness to it. And then I ended up at the Royal Shakespeare for years playing lead roles, you know, you got to play King John and Orlando and As You Like It and Bertram and All's Well That Ends Well, and you know, Brutus and Julius Caesar. And I got to, for the great director Trevor Nunn, I played Henry VI in The Wars of the Roses, and got to open the new indoor theatre at the Globe doing The Duchess of Malfi. So I was on this path that I hadn't set out to do. I'd never imagined I'd be a Shakespeare kind of actor. But it's like that's what people see you doing, and so, oh, you're good at that, so you can carry on. So I think since 2017, I ended up doing, that was the one when I did Julius Caesar. And then after that, I thought I've got to make some changes. And so it was at that point, it hadn't been my happiest experience. And doing 100 shows, we were all kind of like togas and sandals. And it felt a bit of a kind of like cosplay Romans. And it wasn't a lot of the Shakespeare done quite modern dress and crazy. But it got me to like really take a look and think, I need to sort my health out. I finally had time. I discovered I had Crohn's disease. So I'd been doing 8 shows a week for 10 years, feeling rough. And I'd never had time to get diagnosed. So I found that out. And then I went to therapy for the first time in my life. And a lot, you know, it was like a real, and so I haven't done any Shakespeare since 2017, but I've got a lot of other stuff sorted. But it was the time when I was like, I need to make a choice. I need to say no to this. I need to do some other stuff. So that's the only agency you can have, because most of the time, even if you do great tapes or great auditions, it's still down to someone else going, that's how I see the role. And you know, there's only certain things you have to hold on to that you have control, which is why it comes back to what I think I was saying about taping, that I feel like I've got some control over that in a way that I don't. I feel a bit out of control when you just turn up into a room for 10 minutes and then it's different when you get to meet the director for the recall, second round.
So are there roles that you are like interested in kind of pursuing now, like particularly?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of part of, there's a few Shakespeare's I think I'm too old to do now. I always thought I'd nail Romeo. But, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio sort of properly, I think his one, you know, I think that's kind of unbeatable, that film. But I always would love to, I'd love to have played that. I would have loved to have played Henry the Fourth, Prince Hal in Henry the Fourth. But I'm getting a bit old for those now. So there's, in terms of Shakespeare, there's not roles that right now I'm desperate to play. But in terms of the filming and stuff I've done, I've done lots of nice guest lead spots for different things. I've got a nice thing that's going to come out next year for Disney Plus, and there's another Netflix show that I just finished filming that will come out later in the year. But I really want to be, the sort of lead role on in a series now. I want to, the way I've led a company in theatre, I want to be able to do that. I want to, the building a character, being day after day, the repetition of it. It's such, like I say, it's such a drug filming. It's so sort of intoxicating. But that's the thing. So it's not really a particular part, but I'd like to be a sort of regular in a series, or, you know, kind of lead role in a movie. And I think I've got the experience and the chops to do it now. Whereas I think, even though I've been doing the 20 years, it's only the last few years I've really been doing a lot of telly. So I feel much more ready to do it now than I think I would have done 5 years ago.
I feel like I can see you doing like a lead role in like maybe a police procedural or a sci-fi drama. I love a good sci-fi drama.
Love to. Yeah. You see, my kids would like that for sure. I've got two beautiful daughters as well, and I think they'd enjoy that a lot. It's one of those things. It's like you sort of learn as you go. I came out to America, and you know, met a whole bunch of people. This was in 2019, I think, 2018, 2019, and I didn't have. When they ask you, who do you see yourself? What kind of actor are you like? And they want to know because they haven't really seen your work. I gave such willy answers of like, I'm, you know, I can do anything. I learned that I should have just given a much clearer answer of Lane. You know, like as someone I admire at the moment, I'm not even like remotely kind of comparing myself to him. I think it's just phenomenal. But there's a show, The Bear.
Oh, yeah, The Bear, sure.
Yeah, so that guy, Jeremy Allen White, you know, I think that his energy on stage, I think I'd love to be able to see something like that.
I definitely see that.
Maybe it's just the curly hair that, you know, but I just think he's phenomenal, and that there's, you know, there's a load of sort of peers that I kind of admire. But I think that if I was to do it again, I'd probably be able to give a clearer answer of the kind of lane I'd like to do. Is that I'd always, I think the parts I do, what's funny, I often end up dying and things. It's quite a tragedy. Maybe I've got a tragedy about me. So yeah, living. So a character that lives. In this one, I don't. You know, in this movie, without it's not a spoiler. Right. But I don't die. But I think it's a vulnerability and an edge. And I think that's what I bring to roles. That's my sort of calling card. That's the thing that I have that comes naturally. So like, even if like a character like this who has a sort of confidence. Think underneath it that I think that's the thing that I'll always have going on is a bit of vulnerability and a bit of, you know, underneath even the swagger.
There was a show on, it was a sci-fi show that was on in 2008 called Fringe. And the main characters was played by this guy, Kirk Acevedo. His name is Agent Charlie Francis, and he was the partner to the main character on the show. And I tell people this a lot. I think those characters even though they're not what you'd call the main character, but they're on the show every week, and they're I think they're very important to the lifeblood and of the show. And I like guys like that. I like character actors. I like guy like that's one of the reasons why I like Rufus, because whenever you see him on screen, you know something good is about to happen. Like there's never a doubt. There's always going to be something good. And I think like you should just hearing your story, I think you you have what's like this thing that a lot of actors have, where there's an energy about you that just attracts good projects and kind of levels you up each time you go along. And I think you don't worry. I think you're going to be where you're supposed to be.
No, thank you, Darren. I know. I feel like it's always relative, isn't it? I feel incredibly lucky that I've had a really, I think that, you know, I'm certainly not right. a household name, you know, by any means, but I feel like I've got hopefully like a level of respect, certainly within the theatre community in the UK from the work I've done and the people that have seen me. And I feel very fortunate that in this industry, I've been able to make a nice living, and I can, you know, can support two beautiful girls, and but it's always relative, isn't it? I don't want to lose the ambition.
Yeah. You got to keep that.
There's more you want to do, and you're not just settling for, and, you know, and I know that, you know, I'm capable of doing it. I'm capable of doing more, but I think you've got to, at the same time, you've got to be really grateful that I'm so grateful to have appeared in this movie. At a time, it's been a sort of tricky few years for our industry. You know, I'm sure you've been meeting loads of people. So you had the pandemic. We were getting back on our feet, and then we had the strikes last year, which kind of messed everything up. And that I don't know what's going on in America right now, but certainly in the UK, people are sort of catching up with the stuff that stopped filming.
Same here.
Last year. So that's a knock-on effect. So there's a whole bunch of people that aren't, you know, that should be working that aren't working. And there's more and more great actors that are available. So people are spoiled for choice. Yeah. So you kind of, it's a tricky time for our industry. And if I'm able to keep working, that's great. And you kind of hope that, you know, like you say, it will look after itself. If you keep on doing good work, treating people with respect, you know, and that people will hopefully want to work with you again. It's like, it's funny now looking back at some of the theatre jobs I did 10 years ago or so, and that I don't think I've ever been difficult, but I'd always be quite, I could get quite fixated on certain things because I always wanted the best. But now I understand it probably as like the ADHD, and I, like since therapy, I think I've been a joy to direct. So I'd never question anything, you know. I might have in the past might have held on to something, but I think now it's just not taking direction personally, knowing that you're there helping each other, that it's a kind of dialogue and it's not a criticism. Right. Being able to take criticism is like those are the things you learn. So I go around the houses, but it's just I feel lucky to be that I've been working this year, and I'm really, you know, grateful to be part of this project.
You know, you're proof positive that part of being an actor, people don't realize is self-care, is self-care.
Oh, my.
And it's probably more totally important than anything else you're going to do, most likely.
I know, because it could swallow you up. And, you know, you watch friends that you've trained with that have given it up, and you realize that it's not because of, and it's not down to talent. It's down to luck, you know, that I'm still in the game 20 years on. The talent's only a small part of it. It's like perseverance, hard work and luck. And you need a lot of that. And if without that, it can swallow you up, acting. You know, you're constantly having people reject you. And if you've got rejection sensitivity, you know, it's an odd choice. But at the same time, but on the flip side, for all those rejections, there's nothing. When you get offered something, that first 10 minutes of like the thrill, the buzz, when you're like, it's a yes, And then it disappears quite quickly, and then it goes straight back to the self-doubt of like, will I actually be able to do it?
Yeah.
You know, yeah, it's quite a short bit. It's a short-lived high, but then you then this other thing kicks in, and like the self-doubt, you know, there's always this part of you watching yourself from the audience. You're on stage, or can I do it? Will I be good enough? You know, and that does, and then it's finding the way to deal with that. Like you say, is that it's just, you know, on a slightly different note, but in it, one of the things actually about self-care is that if you can, this is what my great mentor, Declan Donnellan, who I was mentioning earlier, taught me, is that if you put all your attention when you're doing a scene on stage, or when you're doing your scene when you're filming, because there's always that little third eye watching you, criticizing you, and the best way to shut that out is to just put all your attention on the other person you're in the scene with. It sounds obvious, but it's like, what do they need to hear? What am I doing to them? So you take all the attention off yourself, and all the attention onto how are these words landing with them? Is this working? Do I need to try something else? And then you have to keep reminding yourself, but the level of like beating yourself up and self-hatred and what you were talking about, self-care, but in a funny way, the best way to bring yourself out of that when you're actually working is to really just think about the other person you're on, you're doing your scene with, and the same thinking about the audience, think about the person, your scene partner, and looking out for them. And if you're looking out for them, then they're looking out for you, and that's when like the scene comes alive, you know. And it's also a way of taking some of that pressure away from yourself.
Oh, man, dude, every actor, I think, even not even just actors, I think anyone who is in the public performance eye, whether it's a musician or a singer or an actor or a comedian, anywhere where judgment is a prevalent thing, and that's, you know, that's every day, and it could be your look, it could be your sound, it could be anytime you have to undergo constant judgment, that has got to be a very difficult thing to kind of deal with. And for anyone who doesn't think they shouldn't, like, I think therapy to me, when someone says I'm going to therapy, it should be fist bumps. It should be, you know, high fives. It should be, that's awesome, you know, because there is nothing wrong with it. And if anything is wrong with you not going.
And my wife, completely, man. And my wife, Amelia Sears, amazing film writer, theatre director, incredible woman, and she knew I needed therapy for years and was just really kind of decent and patient, and she knew there'd be a time when I'd be ready for it, and she knew. But you're right, it takes, like, I'd sort of probably dismissed it for far too long, and she knew how much I needed it, and until you've gone through it, you don't realize quite how transformative it can be, and what a knock-on effect. Like I was mentioning about the Crohn's disease, but I was living in fight or flight mode all the time. So I was just I saw someone the other day who I'd sort of trained at drama school with, and he said, "Why, you've kind of calmed down a bit, man. Like, you were quite," and I didn't realize at the time, but you're flooding your gut with adrenaline. Mm. And so the biggest thing that's helped me deal with that kind of Crohn's is like just not being stressed. That was the biggest thing, and that was down to therapy. So it's all this sort of knock-on effect. It's not only about your mental health, but my physical health is so much better.
There's that too.
And you know, like you say, it's can for people that are performing, you're putting yourself out there for criticism, but at the same time, you're probably looking for approval in some way as well. You know, it's like it's this weird mix that you kind of. As painful as one is, as we've already, it's like these opposites that we live for, and we don't really understand the rejection without the kind of being accepted, without the acceptance. And the same way, we don't appreciate the acceptance without having some knockbacks along the way, you know. But it definitely, you know, for those people that haven't tried it, a total game changer. Mm. And I think, like, my kids, their favorite person in the world is my therapist. You know, since I've gone to that, I've been like way more steady, you know. Like, I've always been a good dad, but just like, they, it's not un, I'm much more kind of.
That's amazing.
Definitely.
It's what's one piece of advice you would give to young actors who are trying to follow in your footsteps?
It's really interesting because I love going to talk, especially my drama school, Lambda. I go and talk Shakespeare to them because I was it was like an evangelical conversion for me because I hated it. It was boring. And then I was like, oh, man, this is really fun. When you finally perform it in front of an audience and you're like, you can see why people love it so much. But I get asked that kind. And I think the first one is like, whatever I tell young actors, they need to go and make the mistakes for themselves. You know, I can give all the best advice in the world, but it's like this, you know, my eldest kid, I remember when she was two, you know, she said, be careful on the stairs, be careful on the stairs, be careful on the stairs. And one time she tried to dance down the stairs and she fell down. She's been careful on the stairs. So like for all the advice in the world I could give, but first, like you need to go and mess up some auditions. You need to kind of, you know, do a lot of the, that's how you'll learn. But having said that, you know, that's the prick. I sort of treating people with respect in the building, whatever building you're in, everyone's there trying to like do their best. So if someone's trying to quick change your costume at the side of the stage, it doesn't matter. This is what I've learned now. Like in the scheme of things, it doesn't matter. If you know, there's like three people know what you're meant to be wearing, you, the director, and the designer, 1,000 people in the audience, they couldn't care less. You know, as long as you're not sort of naked, you're fine. So just treat people with respect. Say please, say thank you. Because those things go, you know, it gets around. There's two artistic directors at the end of every season in the theatre. They go to the hair, wigs, makeup department. And we're like, who are the divas? And who was nice? And those things will get noted. And you have to be super, super, super talented if you're not going to be nice to people, you know, to get on. And it's the same when you're on a film set. It's like everyone's there, they want it to be the best. Then those people, the people running to get you cups of teas and coffees, it's just like, no, learn their name, say please and thank you, work hard. It's like, I think the biggest bit of advice is just knowing that you're gonna have whatever people tell you. I've been doing this 20 years and I still go to auditions and can't remember my name, you know. It's like you sit in there for whatever reason, you sort of suddenly feel, you just, some days you feel comfortable, some days you don't, you know, some days you feel but it's like, you have to kind of go through that a few times before you learn it. And there's no, when something's right, it's right, you know. I think that's the thing. I get sent something and it's like, if you're right for the part, you're right for the part. And often we want to have control. This is the other thing I think I've learned as a control freak. We want to have control. We want to think when we don't get a part, we messed up the audition. We probably nailed the audition. It's just someone was more right for that role than you are. We want to feel that it was something we could do differently. And unless you were rude to people in the room or, you know, those things you can control of learning your lines and making strong choices, all of that stuff's fine. But just knowing that it's not your fault if you don't get a part, it's quite a relief and a release, you know, because actually when I've sat the other side of the table casting, you see great people and for whatever reason they may not be right for something, and it's not because of their talent. And so so that's what I'd say, just the parts you don't get, it's probably nothing to do with you or your talent, it's just someone's more right for it, you know. And when it is your turn, it'll be your turn.
And something you said up front, which was about the self-taping. You know, when you go to a live audition, you bring things with you off the subway transit. Yeah. Well, the same thing happens to the people who are sitting there listening to you as well. You know what I mean? You can't adjust for that. You don't know what's going on in that person's life. And, you know,
you don't know who's just been in the room before you. That's what I mean. I think there's something more democratic about taping, is that that you're not being judged on the chat, you know, small talk. You're being judged purely on, like, this is how I see the character based on the advice that you've given me. Here it is. And if it chimes with you, great. If it doesn't, then okay. But I'd much rather that it's there's something fairer to me that it's not about the kind of immediate, because often I've booked jobs just from tapes. But sometimes it's like your first round and then you meet the director, but then you know that they already see you. They can see you as that role. And then, so when you feel like when you go in to meet them personally, it's on a different level. But I just think there's, I book gigs when my wife kind of taping with me, we've been trying to get the kids out the door to go on holiday. I did this show called Strike Back and playing like a Russian hitman. And I remember getting, it's like, oh man, don't you want to get a Russian? You know, it's like, I can't do this. And so because we're packing bags, we're trying to get kids out, and you know, you've only got like two takes, and it's like, this is crazy. But because of that, the kind of carelessness and the carefree attitude, you end up, you know, I booked it, you know, and no one, they don't see. Like nowadays, I go to a studio and do it, so I don't have to bother my wife. The last thing she needs at the end of the day is me sort of messing around with lights, trying to do a 20th take. You know, it's like, that one's fine. But yeah, I a lot of actors don't love it. They like being in the room, but it's, you know, it's for me, it's just, there's something pure about just being judged on your, this is how I see the part. So I just tell actors young to embrace that, because it's actually more, you have more chance of being seen for something now with taping, because it's cheaper. You know, they can see more people rather than booking a room. So just embrace it, do your best thing, send it in, and know that it's watched. They're not going to waste your time asking you to tape without watching it, you know? So just don't feel, someone's going to see
it. Well, okay? Before we go, I was going to ask you this real quick.
Yeah.
Any thoughts towards writing or directing or producing down the road?
Well, I've tried my hand at producing a bit. My wife and I kind of have a theatre company, and it's quite a nice way of working as producer and director. Rather than, you know, I think that I'd like to think I'd be different now. But I remember when my wife sort of directed me early on, we ended up in a couple of shows together. But you don't want to sort of read the subtext of like, can you move stage left? Is like, why didn't you do the washing up last night? So actually director, producer is quite a nice way of working together. Writing, it's one of those things that great writing is so difficult to do. Writing great dialogue takes such a skill, and I don't feel like I've got anything to say. Or I think again, if someone told me I had to write a script, I'd probably be able to do it, because it would give me that external motivation that I'd need with my ADHD. But I can't. These people that can just sit and write, I just find incredibly impressive. Directing, I kind of enjoy. I quite like working with students on stuff. But yeah, it's not. I think producing is probably the most likely that I'd go back to. I'd love to be able to like produce on films one day, you know. I think that I love the kind of idea of all aspects of it, bringing it together. But yeah, not immediately, but I think one day I'd go back to producing for sure.
What's next for you? Anything else?
I've filmed a series with Disney that will come out next year, and then I've did this other Netflix thing's coming out later in the year, but I don't know. I've got no acting work lined up, but as is always the way, something will come in and you hope you book it. I'm going to take my kids and my other half. We're going to go away on holiday tomorrow. So for a nice week in Spain, so recharge a bit. That's all that matters. And I think that's really, you know, it's a great, having kids, having a family, it really helps you realize that, you know, ultimately it's great that this is my profession, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you get a line wrong. It doesn't matter if something like, you know, there's more important things in life. And that's really helped sort of, I think, level me out a bit.
Amen to that. Well, you can go on vacation. Your show Scoop is out, so you can kind of sit back and enjoy that the response, which I think is going to be very warm and welcoming, and you know, come back recharged and see what comes next, you know.
And go again exactly. I really, thanks, Darren.
I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me.
Oh man, thank you. It's really nice talking to you.
Where can people follow you on social media anyway?
Yeah, I'm the worst social media person ever. I sort of very rarely, you know, I kind of feel like I don't really have much to add. Like, I think people probably hear enough of my
opinions. That's okay. That's the one less thing you have to do.
So I'm my name. So it's Waldman, So WALDMA2NNN Alex Waldman at Waldman Alex is like my Twitter and my, well, it's not Twitter anymore, X and yeah. Instagram, but I'm not on That's it okay. so much. But
there's nothing to see.
There you go. Yeah, everyone else is saying it. Well, you know, everyone's saying it louder.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time and talking to me, and enjoy your vacation with your family.
Thank you, Darren. Thank you so much, man.
Congratulations on the show. It's amazing.
Thank you. I hope people enjoy it. I think it's a fun watch. Hour 40 minutes, and even if you think you know the interview, there'll be stuff that I think people will still enjoy.
Great. Yeah. And everybody, please make sure you like and follow me on The Darren Jenkins, where you can find the podcast. Drop the Mic. We'll be out next week. This will actually be out sooner, because I think we're going to drop this special for the Netflix show. So,
Great.
So I'll let you know when it drops. But don't worry. You go on vacation, relax, enjoy yourself.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Darren.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, man. Thanks. Great to see you.